Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Hybrid Jazz is a vision of all that is jazz, both traditional and contemporary, domestic and global. Here's your host, Trish Hennessy.
Well, thank you, Dave. As Gomer Pyle used to say, surprise, surprise, surprise. It's Monday afternoon, not Tuesday afternoon. What gives? Well, I'll tell you what. When George Duke says that he can do Monday, but not Tuesday, you change your schedule. That is all there is to it, bottom line. So glad that you could join us. Oh, my gosh. I am so psyched. I was just telling my son a little bit ago that it's going to be one of those days. 10 pages of notes right here. George joins us next hour. There's a 3-hour difference between where we are in Baltimore, Maryland, and where he is in California. So I don't know how much time he's going to spend with us, but this hour ahead of when he is supposed to arrive, as it were, is going to be devoted to him, George Duke. What I think that he would like, stuff that he's been involved in, inspirations, songs that he's never heard that I think he might like, you'll see for yourself. It's going to be a really cool hour. Trust me. You might not be the same person that you were a couple of hours from now. We'll see about that. Let's start out with a true inspiration. The first one that George Duke ever had. It's actually Duke Ellington, Rockin' in Rhythm from the Millennium Anthology on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Woohoo! We'll be right back.
like the snow when the ray of sun is fair. And I'm crazy about you, baby, can't you see? I'd be so delighted if you would come with me.
You needed that. You know you did. We all did. Jeffrey Osborne. What a monumental moment for Jeffrey Osborne back in the early 80s. LTD was cooking, but there was some tension. Jeffrey wanted to have a life. He knew that he didn't get into the group as the person who was the focal point, but he had become the focal point, and he was chomping at the bit to do his own thing. So he wanted to find somebody as he was leaving LTD who had an ear for what he had in mind. And who did he turn to? But George Duke. George had some success, God knows, in the jazz world, but he was getting into this beyond funky vibe, getting into some pop hits, Denise Williams, Michael Jackson. He was doing his Taste of Honey thing. All of these songs are coming to mind in the past few days as I was preparing all of this. And Jeffrey and George just had this vibe together. Amazing that On the Wings of Love didn't reach more success than number 29 on the pop charts. But honest to gosh, it's one of those songs. What a test of time, huh? I mean, everywhere you go still, for a while it was being played on the contemporary jazz charts, but it's one of those songs, a pivotal, let's get married to this song kind of a forever vibe that Jeffrey Osborne and George Duke as producer just put out there. That's from Jeffrey's self-titled debut from 1982, On the Wings of Love. We heard too from George himself, a melody from Deja Vu, starring, by the way, on the Stylus RMX synth. A couple of years ago now, 2010, Michael Manson on bass, Paul Jackson Jr. on guitar, Terry Dexter, Lynn Fidmont, Lamont Van Hook on vocals, and Ronald Bruner Jr. on drums. Just bringing that Brazilian love affair into the 2010 year and just making us believe all over again how eclectic and how much of a genius George Duke is. I mean, honest to God, being trained in the classics and then delving into the clubs in the Northern California scene. A lot of stories with Al Jarreau, and those stories continue, by the way. Oh, my gosh. Then just finding his way into Jean-Luc Ponty's life, and that was a story in and of itself, making sure that he got immersed in some avant-garde music, courtesy of Frank Zappa. We'll delve into all of this with George next hour, but I'm just overwhelmed in reacquainting myself with the breadth of his work through the years, since the 60s. And even he on his website has his work divvied up into decades. It's just mesmerizing. Duke Ellington to start the set, Rockin' in Rhythm from his Millennium Anthology, 1931, recorded January 16th in New York, my late sister's birthday, so it's really special. Duke Ellington was rocking and rolling as part of the Cotton Club, actually from 1927, and that particular track had Fred Guy on banjo. What a concept. Just a foreshadowing of the big band swing of the latter part of the decade and then into the early 40s. A great song there, and I thought George Duke might appreciate that. Trish Hennessy and Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy continues. And let me tell you something, we have a lot of music. Holy cow, programmed a lot for this hour. Not so much next hour. Don't know how much time George is going to be able to give us. Keep your fingers crossed. But as long as we can go, I want to make sure you get your taste of George Duke today and inspirations and songs that he would like and songs that he had a hand in producing. Miles Davis, Tutu, 1986. One of songs on there produced by George, Backyard Ritual. Let's get to it, shall we? Oh, yeah, this is so cool. Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Backyard Ritual. I'm not sure what he had in mind, but then again, none of us ever really know what George Duke has in mind.
baby is born without any sin. Daddy dark as the night, mama light as the day. He was too young to tell and unaware of his creed. Remember everybody looking at the little half-breed. Staring at the little half-breed, and I can't believe the hurtful things they say.
They can be so
don't
cruel.
Know why they saw me in a different way.
Don't come
did
mind.
They realize that if we all play, they would see
red.
They'd just see red. Time to find me a job, application in sight. Please check the right box. Are you black? Are you white? I never understood, but skin tone shouldn't matter anyway. Now that I'm a man, I still feel the same way. Yeah. Don't you feel the same way?
Yeah.
Now, you know I was going to get a little radical on you during this hour before George Duke comes along at the top of next hour. Fingers crossed. I always get a little nervous about these things. I've got utter faith that God will take care of me, but this petty little stuff about folks just coming. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, George Duke music right there. Love from the album Feel from 1974. Oh, my gosh. Now, why did I play that? Well, delving into the decades and reacquainting myself with older George Duke music and knowing that my roots were in Philly. So we were coming from a different place in Philadelphia as far as music is concerned, especially folks who were involved in rock music. We were all over the map as far as Frank Zappa is concerned. And, of course, George was with Frank for a while, had a really tight, loving relationship. And acquainting myself with that work from back in the day was a trip because we're going back now to 1970 or so. So some of us know that time and we're cognizant of it some of the time, and some of us were not. Zappa is on guitar on that track, but he is not billed as Frank Zappa. His name is Abdul X. He is playing on that track, and he's also playing on Old Slippers. And George said the interesting scenario in recording the Feel album was that Fantasy Records had a love affair going with jazz artists. So the recording studios were full of the comings and goings of different folks. And I'm talking top-of-the-line jazz artists. So you can imagine the trip they were going through to see Zappa working with George. I guess at this point, even though it was early on, they expected anything from George Duke. So I guess it wasn't too much of a shock. But George is the definitive hybrid artist, is he not? One of the inspirations for calling this show Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy is indeed George Duke. We also heard from Miles Davis from 2-2, 1986, Backyard Ritual, produced by George. It was supposed to be the project with Miles, a collaboration with Prince. That did not work out. Marcus Miller took over. Sure enough did. And Marcus did a lot of work with Miles Davis. I'm not exactly sure how the scenario came to be that George would produce two tracks for Miles Davis in Miles' career, but we won't even quibble about that. Maybe George will throw us a bone and tell us that. There's so much that we want to ask him. But that particular track was certainly the direction that Miles was feeling these days, and George had already been entrenched in that direction. So it was a natural marriage, don't you think? We heard, too, from Eric Scott. We're going to hear a couple of Washington, D.C.-based artists back-to-back. Eric Scott, one of those fascinating cats that should be international. What a voice he has from 2007's Red CD. Just not necessarily what you would consider in any way, shape, or form, even a hybrid jazz artist, but just has this strong, soulful, truthful, authentic vibe. And when he sells a song, my God, you're right there. That was a song talking about growing up in his biracial circumstances and what did he feel? Who was he? And it just smacked me right between the eyes when I heard it. And I thought, you know what? It would resonate with George Duke a lot to hear somebody like Eric Scott do his thing. And hopefully if George will listen in the archives when this gets done a little bit later on tonight, maybe he'll listen to the music. EricScottMusic.com is where you need to go, exactly the way it's spelled. Elliot Levine is another one of those Washington, D.C. artists, just amazing on the keyboard. Had an album out a couple of years ago, 2008, actually recorded January at one of the clubs in town. It's called Live Plus 7. Thought it would be a kick to hear Elliot's version, just so tender, so passionate, because he worships George Duke. This is No Rhyme, No Reason, Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Thank you.
Thank you. think about your loving, the sunny evenings, the fun we used to share. Looking through the memories in my mind, since I've laughed and cried and thought it over, now I realize that it's never over, only set aside. Thoughts are only you, wandering through the memories in my mind. How could love for real have turned so empty? I just keep wondering why. Will I ever find the love we shared together?
Much to be said about that song, and I think a gazillion babies later, I think that would say it all. From 1981, the Clark Duke Project, George Duke and Stanley Clark, Sweet Baby. Just an amazing story about that, and I hope George talked to us about it, but I certainly wanted to make sure that I sort of eased into the next hour while that song was playing, because I just love it. I mean, there they were in the midst of this project, and George is looking out at the water one afternoon, and the song really came to him quickly. He had some kind of inspiration, and he had a couple of rooms rented out for the project because they were a little bit out of town. And he said to Stanley, I want you to hear this song. And he didn't know what Stanley was going to think of it. Maybe he thought he was going to hate it, but Stanley loved it. The next day, they recorded it, and you would think that it would be no problem with the record company thinking, man, that's pretty hot, that song. But the R&B department of Epic had a problem with it. And that's where the story gets really interesting, so we'll let George talk about that. Yeah, 1981, bringing us up to 2011, Micah Chevalier in the middle of that mix, and a song that she did with keyboardist extraordinaire Daoud Saeed. At one point, I have to tell you this story, there was a group of us at Ram's Head, and George was playing there a few years ago. So, you know, you get a couple of glasses of wine and Shaniqua, and she just goes. Shaniqua is my alter ego. So we happened to meet George Duke afterwards, and I introduced Daoud as the best keyboardist in the world. And George said, "Really?" I said, "Yes, it's just a little joke, George." And George thought it was very amusing. But Daoud is doing keyboard. Micah is on vocals there, redoing the Duke Ellington, John Coltrane whole vibe there in a sentimental mood. Just love that classic song, and Daoud and Micah wanted to record it in a certain way. You heard the special way in which it is done. And it just is it's pretty cool. If you go to Micah, MYCAH.net, as far as I understand, and Micah will correct me because she's in the chat room along with some lovely others, but when you go to Micah.net, you'll go to Reverb Nation. That's where you can buy the song. It just got issued as a single. The permission was granted, so life is good. And there is a video on the project as well. But I was thinking of George and Duke Ellington because George, and I think he might get a little embarrassed with this story, but anyway, his mom took him to see Duke Ellington when George was 4. And he went crazy. He chanted, "I want a piano, I want a piano, I want a piano," after he saw Duke Ellington play, because it was not only that Duke Ellington affected him, but George thought that he and Duke Ellington were related because of Duke. Oh, little guy. So you know what? That was good for him. It was good for him to think that they were related, because I think it was part of the inspiration for him to get to be the genius that he has come to be. And actually, he was always a genius, but we've just seen that genius flower and flower through the years. Amazing stuff. Elliot Levine, we heard from No Rhyme, No Reason, the George Duke song from actually George's 1992 Snapshot project. Elliot recorded this with his illustrious band, Ernest Abdul Rahim on bass and James Carney on percussion, Vinton Jones on drums a couple of years ago from the Live Plus 7 CD. Micah Chevalier, Elliot Levine, and a little bit past you heard Eric Scott. They're all from the Washington, D.C. area. And man, it just seemed to be the right idea to have local and regional beloved artists played back-to-back with folks that are basically household names like Miles Davis and certainly George Duke. Now, it is my time, 4:01, and I thought that I would talk a little bit so that maybe George would come on the line, but that's okay. I'm just pleased to get him even for 5 minutes. So what I'll do is this. I'll play a little something for you here that he pointed out he would like to see redone. This is going back a little bit. This is going back to actually a CD that T bought me for Christmas. And I was quite taken when T got the CD for me because I was totally not expecting it. Love the Blues. I love the blues. She Heard Me Cry. And this song is a short little song, so hopefully it'll be just enough time for George to check in. Oh, wait a minute. I think he is. Maybe we'll hold off on that. Let's do that, shall we? Because I do not want to keep this man waiting. And actually, I've written something here that pretty much encapsulates what the career of George Duke has been like. Because, you can just say genius so many times. And we all have done that in regard to George. But actually, this is pretty succinct as to what I would like to say about George Duke. Songwriter, producer, arranger, singer, small, medium, and large musical director, professor of music, copied more than Kinko's, sampled more than Joe, in short, a genre-crossing, keyboard-kissing, multi-functioning, hybrid Hassenpfeffer, of all things funky, fused, and fine. And ladies and gentlemen, with that, I give you George Duke.
Can I use that?
You sure can.
That's a long sentence, though.
Hey, listen, you know what? You have to have the buildup. You have to have more than one sentence, and I couldn't possibly use or overuse the word hybrid because it's in the title of the show here.
Yeah, I do. I am kind of a hybrid, that's for sure.
Oh, my God, are you ever. George, and I'm tickled that you even had this much time to fit in because you have a busy week, and I am certainly aware of that, so thank you.
No problem. Thank you.
Listen, you know what? Honest to gosh, my son is 19, so I'm going back in time over the weekend. We were immersed in the stuff that you did in the 70s.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm listening to Phil. T is tripping because he really has not heard that, but he's very curious about my days at Temple University. And that's what we used to hear all the time.
Uh-huh.
There's only 6 years difference between you and me. Your birthday is this week.
Yes.
So I was right there with you when you were turning these tunes out. When you look back and see that from the 60s, you were progressing into this person that you're still progressing into. What do you think these days of you and your work?
Well, you know, it's funny because you're never satisfied. It's almost like a great basketball player. There's always something that you can continue to work on your game. You know, it's almost the same thing with music. You know, there's always something that you're lacking. You know, and you want to improve it, and if you have the mindset, and at least a young mind, even if you aren't young, that will continue you to try to better yourself, you know, one way or the other. Or even though certain things like the voice, you know, I can't sing as high as I used to. There's certain things that physically, you know, like that, I can't do anymore. I just, you know, it's impossible to reach those high notes that I used to sing back in the day. But there are other ways to do things. So, you know, just continue to work on your game. What do I think about me? There's certain things I like, you know, that I've done in my career. Certain things I don't think are so good that I could have been better. And that's kind of it. You know, I mean, that's the reality of it. Certain things I really love and certain things I don't. And I'm honest about it.
Oh, I know you are. And that was another thing I said to T last night before I went to sleep. I said, you know, honey, I'm looking at what George wrote about himself. And I need to get T's input because he's light years ahead of most 19-year-olds as far as music is concerned. Mm. I said, you know, George is pretty harsh with himself sometimes when he assesses some of the albums that he's done through the years. And quite rightly, you have the absolute right to say that some of the record companies didn't pull through for you as far as some tracks are concerned. They didn't give the push. I just played Sweet Baby, and you have to tell us that story because I trip every time I hear that story about you being called too white. Here you are, Stanley and George doing this white song, and the R&B department didn't want to touch it.
That's true. Well, it was kind of interesting because I knew immediately when Stanley and I were talking about it and decided to do this song, even when I wrote it, I said, I don't know whether this is for Clark Duke or not, or my album, because it's so different than anything else I've ever done. And so I played it for Stanley. Stanley says, I love it, man. Let's record it tomorrow. The next day we went in the studio and cut it and became really the biggest record either one of us has ever had. But when we finished it and gave it to Epic Records, we knew it was kind of a poppy kind of song, so we went to the pop department. They said, well, there's nothing we can do with this for 3 or 4 months. He said, first of all, you guys are a black act. You know, you're an R&B act, and there's nothing really, you know, we're not saying we won't do it, but we can't get to it. We have other priorities. We went to the R&B department, and we were part of the progressive jazz department now. We went to the R&B department. They told us that this is a pop song. Nothing we can do with this. You know, you guys are jazz artists. And, of course, we went to the progressive department and said, this is not a progressive song. So, in other words, it was not going to happen.
Right.
So Stanley and I went out, took our own money, hired these independent guys to go out, and Cliff Goroff, actually, is his name, and this other guy had a company here who specialized in crossing over records. We hired them at our own expense to go out and promote this record. And when it started happening, Sony kicked in. But they had summarily dismissed us. But it would not have happened unless Epic had come in and eventually completed the job.
And there was a big to do, because I remember I'll be 60 this year, so I remember back in the day, and some of the underlying stuff that you don't necessarily hear the common person, but being involved in radio, I knew MTV did not play the video.
No, we thought. I guess we were naive. You know, Stanley and I thought, look, the kind of music we play is not just straight-ahead jazz. It's, you know, it's we have a nice pop kind of song. We did a video. We had the whole thing. We thought that we would get play on MTV, but we were totally wrong. You know, it took Michael Jackson to break down that barrier. And, of course, we were quite disappointed because we thought, wow, a station that's going to play music. It's okay to play the British rock groups and the punk rock and all of that, but we thought there would be a certain segment that they would have music that was a little different. But that was not the case at that time.
In seeing the progression, and I really appreciate that you took the time on your website to make sure that it was your take, your feeling, and the truth of what was in each of these projects through the years. Because, you know, you were on Cool Jazz Conversations about a year ago, and I didn't want to rehash different kinds of elements of your illustrious career with anything but what you have said about it. Because I guess it makes you mad when folks speak for you as far as, oh, well, you know, George was all about, you know, they try to define you. Do you ever chafe at the notion of being tried to define? How would you define yourself?
Well, I used to call myself a multi-stylistic artist. I decided early on that I didn't want to just be a jazz artist.
Right.
You know, even though I'm in those bins, which I respect that and I accept that. That's because that's where I came in. But that's not totally what I'm about musically. I mean, I've continued to renew my goals, and the one goal was to I'd like to have a number one record. You know, I mean, and not to sell my soul, but I mean, it was a goal to say, wonder if a little jazz artist that grew up in Marin City, California, could actually put a song together and have it reach number one on the, you know, jazz charts, or the number one on the R&B charts. And once I was able to attain that, I kept looking for other goals. It never made a number one pop record, but that's okay. It was, you know, it was a very interesting study, you know, in renewing goals. But I always consider myself a multi-stylistic artist, someone that can do a lot of different things well. And I think that contributes to me being still being around. You know,
it's more than a few people who say this, and I'm always intrigued by it because I have read so much about what people have to say about George Duke, and usually it's off the charts fabulous. But one of the things I've noticed that some superior, intellectually speaking now, critiquers say about you is that you are an underrated keyboardist.
Yeah, I've heard that too. Well, see, here's the deal. For about 20 years, or maybe even 25 years, I would say from 1983 to maybe even up to 2000, I actually didn't tour very much. I mean, I was in the studio producing Jeffrey Osborne or Anita Baker or whoever, Barry Manilow, Miles Davis. I was in the studio working with other artists as a producer and not out there playing, you know, and that actually started happening around 1981, 82, you know, and I just kind of stuck with it. It kept me home, and I only went out every now and then. I go to Montreux Jazz Festival, you know, during the summer or do a few dates. So I didn't play all this time, you know, and so I think people, a lot of people forgot that I really play keyboards, you know, so I'm back out there doing it now, so it's a whole different scenario, you know.
Yeah, and then you're certainly going to be doing that this week because, man, I'm telling you what, we've got an active little chat room today, and I know that I can speak for every single one of these people. If we had the wherewithal, we'd be flying out to California this week because you're going to have a three-day stretch at Catalina Bar and Grill in L.A., right?
Yep. Yeah, I decided they've been trying to get me in there again for a long time, and so I thought this would be a perfect opportunity. I am still in the studio producing a record right now, but I said, let me take this time. They offered the 3 days, and I said, hey, that coincides with my birthday. So I said, that's great. So let's do it. And I just going to bring the quartet, and we're going to have a good time. I'm leaving the singers home this time, and we're just basically it's more of a playing gig. I don't want to do the same thing that I do in larger concerts. Like last time I played in L.A., we played the Hollywood Bowl, you know, with Marcus Miller and David Sanborn. That's a whole different thing. So
yeah.
I decided for this thing, let's do something a little different. This is kind of the fusion funk band.
Cool. And I saw the agenda. I mean, the tour schedule, again, is nuts through 2012.
Well, it will be. Yeah, you're probably looking at the 2011 schedule. I haven't actually. I got to take that down. That's the 2011 schedule, but the 2012 schedule will be as crazy.
Yeah,
I just haven't posted it yet.
Well, let me ask you this then: are you going to be at Burke's this year or not, or Cap Jazz Fest?
Yes, I'll be at Capitol Jazz Fest with Stanley Clark.
Okay, great.
And that's not
great.
On the website yet. None of that, the updates have not been made to my live schedule yet. But,
okay.
Yeah, I start working with Stanley in April, May, somewhere in that area.
Fabulous. Now, listen, I wanted to run this by you in case you didn't know. In Baltimore, which is the birthplace of Frank Zappa,
There
is now a bust of him in front of the Highland Town Library. And it was donated by somebody in Poland because they really loved Frank's work through the years and thought he needed to have some sort of homage. When you look back at the different decades of your career, George, how was that time with Frank in retrospect to what you're feeling musically now?
Oh, it was crazy. First of all,
yeah, I know that.
It was, I don't know if I really knew going into it what was going to be involved. You know,
yeah.
It's because this was, but Frank interested me. I mean, it was just like the guy was the closest thing to a genius that I can think of. You know, and I don't use that word lightly. But I figured something told me I had a lot to learn, and I just needed to do this. But the days were totally I learned so much. Let me put it this way. He's the first one to get me involved with playing synthesizers, the first one to get me involved in seriously thinking about singing. He used to tell me that I need to come to the front of the stage and find a way to get out from behind this wall of keyboards.
Mm-hmm.
He would tell me, you need to invest in yourself, trust your talent. He says, it'd be better for you to invest in yourself than in the stock market, because he says, in the end, you're going to be worth more, you know, in the long run. You know, just a lot of little gems of things that he basically it became to belief. If I need a piece of equipment to make my art come true to the vision I see in my mind, he says, you will find a way to do it. Find a way to do it. And he just kept pushing me. I see him work in the studio. And so it just, who I am today is very, very much a large part of what I learned from working with Frank Zappa. Now, there's, and the Mothers.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's so wild to know that as you're following the progression of George Duke musical history, you can see some changes and then a return, some changes and then a return. And then deja vu, wow.
Yeah, you keep going back.
Yes. And,
well, you know, the funny – go ahead. Let me tell you one little funny thing. You know,
oh, please.
Probably the biggest part of what I learned from working with Frank was humor. And I kept wondering, like, especially during the fusion era, I said, man, where's the humor in this? And I just got out of left Frank in 1975 and put a band together with Billy Cobham in 1976 called the Cobham Duke Band. And I told Billy, I said, look, I dig fusion. The heavy musicians doing all this stuff. And I said, we were doing a lot of heavy fusionist kind of things with Zappa even, you know. But that wasn't the only thing we did. And the humor element was very important and played almost like a what's the word I'm looking for? It played off of each other. You know, the music that was very intense to the stuff that was humorous, and he played them against each other, you know, and it was kind of interesting. So I was wondering what would happen if we did that in fusion. Well, I began wondering what would happen if you did that in anything, you know, in R&B. I said, where's the humor in R&B? And I began thinking about what happened to the humor in jazz. Like, everybody got so serious.
Yeah.
You know, like, go to concert halls, which is wonderful, playing Carnegie Hall and all that. But you look at Fats Waller, you look at Dizzy Gillespie, these guys were funny.
Oh, my God. And
so I decided to let my humor out. I decided that was one huge thing I learned from Frank is to look, who you are on stage really is just a larger part of what you are off stage. You know, and you're funny off stage. Why don't you let some of that out on stage? Let your personality out. So I learned a lot. I just wanted to cap that off.
And actually, George, we were just talking about this the other day because one of my friends is Tony Bunn, who is this amazing. He's not only a world class bass player, but he's also has been a rocket scientist.
Wow.
Yes. So he just went back to Denmark. He's a first-time daddy at the age of 54, and he was laying some stuff out the other day, and the basic definition of jazz is from those Fats Waller days, even beyond. It's from jazzum, which is actually a derivative of seminal fluid.
Yeah, jazz comes from the brothels. Let's put it that
way. That's right. That's right. And anybody who's an elitist, I get the biggest kick out of the folks who poo-poo the notion of what jazz is, because you know what? Jazz is what you feel. It ain't what somebody wrote down some years ago.
Yeah, it's actually dance. It's a dance music, you know. It's once the dance got taken out of it, I think it really affected the popularity of the music, you know. And because people need to feel something. So I mean, you can be serious about the thing about the music, because I'm very serious about music. But at the same time, you know, you can lighten up. Frank used to tell me that all the time. He says, "Man, you're too serious. You need to lighten up." You know, because that's why he got this idea of me walking around with a Downbeat magazine in my hand, so I looked like I knew I was hip, you know, and made me do it in the movie. And he wrote this line because he liked things from real life to wind up on stage. So it's very, no joke, I mean, probably single-handedly the most influential person I've had, probably besides Miles Davis, would have been Frank Zappa. And then outside of that would have been Cannonball Adderley. Those two guys together.
Wow. Yeah. If folks don't know, there was a movie, and let us acquaint you with this, 200 Motels, back in the day. This is like 1970, George.
Yep.
Oh, my God. That was the very beginning of when Frank reformed the Mothers of Invention.
Right. Right, they had the Turtles, Mark and Howard Kalin, and Mark Bowman, and this crazy guy on bass named Jeff Simmons, and Ainsley Dunbar was the drummer at the time, and it was
Ainsley Dunbar.
All these guys, and it was a very interesting band. Ian Underwood, so he had some guys from the old Mothers, and then me, and I was playing more trombone than anything else.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Because lest anybody doesn't know this who's listening, you have a bachelor's degree in trombone and composition with a minor in contra freaking bass, huh?
Yes, that's true. That's true. Oh, well, my cousin taught bass at the Conservatory of Music there. And so, you know, he used to come by, and after I found out he was my cousin, he used to come by every Sunday and have dinner. My mom would make lunch, and he would bring his bass, and we'd start playing. And that's how I learned how to play jazz, was really with him, you know, besides the little gigs that I played around town. So, yeah, I play trombone, but I told Frank when I rejoined the band in 73, I told Frank, I said, look, I will not be playing trombone. And he didn't need me because he had Bruce Fowler. He had a great trombone player.
Oh, my gosh. Those were some amazing times. I believe that at one point, George, you were with Frank in Washington, D.C., although I confess I don't remember much of the concert because I was drinking Thunderbird wine or something.
Don't tell anybody.
Oh, my God. So here we are at Deja Vu. If you go to George's website, it's really cool because, oh, man, George and Al Jarreau and the guys were at Burke's last year, and it was really sweet to see this connection after years, after the 60s, when what? Al was a social worker, and you were playing the clubs. You were doing your thing at night, and you have an album on your website that you are making sure folks know about from 65? 67?
Yeah. Yeah, I just happened to turn the tape recorder on, and Al called a Wolin Sac, but it was not a Wolin Sac. It was this little two-track Sony and a little mic that I bought at, microphone that I bought at Thrifty for about $5 or $10, and put four mics on stage. Everybody had it. Your bass player had one mic, the drummer had one mic, Al had a mic, and the piano had a mic. And I turned it on through this little $10 mixer and turned it down as far as I could get it and recorded, sent it out to every record label that we could think of that might be interested in us, summarily turned down by everybody. But I kept the tapes, you know, all this time, and so I kept them in my little library, and I called Al one day because I happened to play it, and I started trying to clean it up a little bit, and because Al's voice was distorted a little bit here and there, you know, and so we did the best we could, but Al, I said, Al, you got to come by the house. You got to hear this. I put this stuff on, and Al started crying.
Oh, Teddy.
I mean, it just really, he just literally broke down because with joy, because it was just, it brought back so many memories. And he, and I said, Al, I think we should release this. And not only that, I think we should go back and do some dates, just me and you with the trio like we used to do, kind of coming back around 360 degrees. And we can still do some new music, but basically that sentimentality, the two of us on stage the way we began. And he agreed. And this is the first album out of three, because I recorded the whole night.
Man, those were some amazing times. And, gosh, I know that you had no inkling of what was to come. And I know that I progress in the story because I was going through each year of the George Duke discography and seeing what you did, which was the equivalent of what Kris Kristofferson did to Johnny Cash, landing in the backyard with a helicopter to try to pitch Johnny Cash's songs. You kind of did that with Jean-Luc Pagny.
Oh, yeah, I did everything I could to try to get that gig. As a matter of fact, it's kind of funny because I just received an email from Jean-Luc yesterday, and we're thinking about doing a date. They have a big Zappa festival called Zappanale in Germany, somewhere in a small town in Germany. And so Jean-Luc and I are going to get together and play the King Kong album, which is the first time that either one of us worked with Frank, was through the King Kong album. And so he thought it was a great idea, and so we're booking it right now.
Oh, my gosh.
But anyway, the long and short of it is, yeah, I sent these tapes down to Jean-Luc, and I said, I have, not just me, but I have the group to play with Jean-Luc, because we really used to hear him all the time on K-Jazz up in the Bay Area, and he sounded like the Miles Davis of violin, and I just knew what to do with this guy. And we made several records together.
And didn't you actually say, I am the only keyboard player for you?
I'm the only, yeah, I became very extroverted, and, yeah, I didn't just stick my foot through the door. It's the first time I ever did that. I said, I got to get this gig. So, something told me it was a pivotal moment in my career, and it was something that I had to do, period. I mean, I went all out, 100 miles an hour, foot pedal to the metal.
And see, honest to God, George, that is why I love you, because there are so many artists, of course, they haven't achieved your kind of status, but so many artists who are so skittish about the timing's got to be right, everything's got to be in place. Oh, no, no. It's 20 miles of barrels full steam ahead for you, because you figure let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah, I mean, what did I have to lose? You know, I mean, it cost me a stamp to put it in an envelope and mail. You know, there was no internet. You know, it was mail. So
right.
I mailed it down. I called. I did everything I could. I know I was a pest. But Jean-Luc apparently heard it and said, okay, let's give the kid a shot. And I was when I got the call, I was like, wow. He said, yes. I couldn't, you know, and I went and told the band, and we learned the material and immediately did a couple of records. You know, the Electric Connection record and a record we did at Dante's, and also the Experience record, which is where I first met Frank Zappa and, you know, Quincy Jones and all those folks. So who came to see Jean-Luc, because he was this amazing violinist that was doing something that no other violinist was doing in progressive jazz, and I just happened to be there.
And actually, man, I was feeling it when you were telling this story. That you wrote, I don't know, a couple of years ago about the fact that you were promised a keyboard for this pivotal gig where Cannonball and Zappa and Q were going to be, and there was no keyboard that you wanted. There was just a little Yamaha?
Yeah, no, it was a Fender Rhodes. It was one of those silver top 73-key Fender Rhodes, and I really didn't want to play it. I had played it with the Don Ellis Big Band, because I had done that back in the late 60s, had joined that band and done a few dates. And I said, look, I'll do the gig at the Rock Club as long as they have a piano. And Jean-Luc had to be talked into it, because we knew it was a rock club. So we're like, why are we playing a rock club? And Dick Bach, who ran World Pacific Jazz Record, told us, he says, you know, with the kind of jazz, the kind of music you guys play, I think you can get over to a younger audience. Just do a couple of songs and put more of a rock beat to it or a soul beat to it, but still play the same stuff you're playing now. That's the beginning of fusion.
Yes, that's right.
You know, so we went in this club and we played a couple of tunes that kind of had a, you know, like a soul beat or a rock beat, and these girls started dancing. In front, there were nobody was sitting down. Everybody was standing up, you know, girls with no bras. And, you know, and here I was with this little, like, where's the piano? There was no piano. So, you know, I had to play this thing, and I found out I could turn it up. I found out that it had vibrato, even though it was clunky. And it definitely had a vibe. And that's the first time I played that instrument. I said, you know what? I think I might be able to play this thing. I played with my feet. I played with my head. I became totally extroverted, and I think Frank says, you know, I like this guy.
Yes, I'm sure, because, you know, he had been through a few roads himself where life dealt him lemons, so he decided to make lemonade, and that's exactly what you did.
That's a good way to put it.
Oh, my gosh. I'm not going to keep you too long, because I know you got to roll, and there are so many other things. I want to ask you, because my son bought me this CD for Christmas, and I had no idea he was going to do it. He's a much hipper kid than anybody realizes. So he got me I Love the Blues, She Heard Me Cry, My
oh.
Cry. Yeah.
Yeah, that's going back there.
Yeah. And
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, that album was a little different than most of the other ones that I'd done prior. First of all, I had a little bigger budget. It was on MPS Records, which later became BASF, a little company out of Villingen, Germany. And this guy had signed me to the label. I had done, like, I think three records before that, The Aura Will Prevail, Feel, and Faces. And so this was like the fourth album of this deal. And they gave me a little more money, and I called all my friends. I mean, I wanted everybody on this record. Like, so I got the Brothers Johnson on there. I got, you know.
Bruce Fowler.
Who?
Bruce Fowler.
Yeah. I got Bruce from Frank's band. Tom Fowler, I believe, played on a track. Janet Hoff, who was also part of that, the Zappa thing. So we kind of had a smidgen of a lot of different people on there, including my first work with Byron Miller, who was then around 18 years old as a bassist.
Yes.
That became the guy that played the solo on Reach For It. when we started the kind of funk band. So that was the beginning of it all, including the Brothers Johnson, you know, the guitar and those guys.
Yeah, Lee Ritenour, too. And Ruth Underwood was there.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my God. It was just so choice. And I made a big
Johnny
deal.
Johnny Guitar Watson.
Yes, I made a big deal on Facebook because there's a lot of people who were paying attention to the fact that you were going to be on today. I wanted to get it out there that you had said that you wish that somebody would record someday.
Yeah, that's true. I wish somebody would take it and do their own thing with it. I mean, I've done it twice. I it's a little too high for me. I can't sing that song anymore, not in that key. But I've been told by several people, yeah, I love that. That's my favorite George Duke song. And I said, well, why don't you record it?
Yeah.
Just do your own thing with it. Well, eventually, Common did it. You know, he did a rap over it. I forgot the name of it, but he did he used the hook and did, what's the name of the song, Corrine? I can't think of the name of the song. I forgot the name of it anyway, but he did it and sampled it, and that was the most unlikely song for somebody like that to do. But I wanted a singer to do it, you know.
Exactly.
Scotty and Walter from The Whisper said, yeah, they told me years ago, he says, I'm going to cut it, man. They never did.
Oh, man. Well, see,
I was hanging out with Eric Benet the other day. Eric Benet says, man, that's my favorite George Duke song. I said, why don't you cut it?
Yes.
I'm going to do it, man. I said, yeah, okay. I'd love to hear Eric Benet do it.
Oh, my God, because he can hit those high notes. And actually, you know, the first time I heard it back in the day, I thought Doberman Pinschers were going to come to the door because that was like one of the highest notes.
Oh,
man.
Yeah, you don't want to know what they had to do to me to get me sing that note that long.
I can only imagine because, after all, George, it was the 70s, okay?
Yeah, that's right. Right.
Well, listen. What do you want to do next time musically? We're going to hear, after you depart from us, a few tracks from Deja Vu. We played a whole hour dedicated to you before you got on with me. What would you think of? Yes, absolutely.
Well,
what do you want to do?
You mean in the future?
Yes. I mean, what do you have in the way of a dream still to do?
Well, there are a lot of things. I got a lot of things I want to do before I check out. I don't think I'm going to do another album this year. I do have another DVD that I cut in Montreal in 2009 with a lot of guest artists, including Lee Ritenour, as a matter of fact, who sat in. Rochelle Farrell sat in. I have a track with Chaka Khan, and I had the Cubanismo horns were playing, and a couple of keyboard players, and a full vocal contingent. It's a great show. It's a little different than this DVD I just put out from Prague about 6, 7, 8 months ago. It's been selling really, really, really well.
Excellent.
It's a larger thing from 2009 that will be released sometime this spring. And I think I may record an album towards the end of the year to be released in 2013. But other than that, I don't think I'll do another record, you know, LP type thing, you know, for a while. But I am producing some other artists, mostly from out of the country. I'm working with an Indonesian artist right now. His name is Jay Alatas, with a lot of good friends of mine on the record. And so I'm continuing that. And I'm working with Stanley Clark pretty much all of this year, as well as Al Jarreau with the smaller dates, you know, with the trio, and then dates with my own band. So I'm doing a lot more playing this year.
Well, that's good. I'm really glad to hear that, because I think people really want to see you, especially as, you know, folks got really involved in Deja Vu because it was a culmination of everything you've done. There was classic, there was straight ahead, there was that love affair with Brazil going on, there was the funk there, the residual, long-lasting, forever effect of Zappa, and then you closed it out with something out of Mahavishnu.
Right.
So it was just awesome to feel the breadth of a career in one CD. So to see you live doing your thing is everything.
Yeah, it's been that type of thrust has kind of been a blessing and a curse, you know, on a certain level, because a lot of people say, well, who is he? Who is that guy? Because he's, you know, he's this, is he that, you know, and I said, I'm all of that. I said, I'm a musician, so I don't think a musician should feel limited by style. Style is irrelevant.
Yeah, yeah.
In that respect.
Oh, listen, George, you know this in your heart of hearts, but let them ask the question. What a ridiculous question. Who are you? You are everything. You've done everything. You know how to do everything. So I can't imagine anybody asking you in anything other than hate. Let the naysayers get the heck out of the way.
Yeah, well, it's happened more than once, you know. And because once I left, I didn't actually leave the straight-ahead jazz world. I just kind of said, I want to see what's going on over here. The Star Trek phenomenon, you know, let's see what's around that star to the left. Basically it's being explorative. It's this, Herbie Hancock did the same thing, Miles Davis did the same thing. Those were like my heroes. Frank Zappa did that. Cannibal Adderley did that. Kept looking around the corner and says, what can I add to my music to keep this interesting and to move on to another level? And it didn't mean you forget where you've been. It just means you're an explorer. You're searching.
Well, I mean, the truth be told, when you were growing up in California, you were listening to all different kinds of music. So how is it that people would put you in a box as you got older? You know?
Well, I started long before I got older. Actually, but when I joined Frank Zappa, I used to, everybody from Ralph Gleason to, Leonard Feather used to say, well, we lost another one.
Oh, please.
And I say, well, they just don't understand it. I didn't let that stop me. I didn't want critics to control what I wanted to do in music. And so I respect their opinion, and they're entitled to it, but I'm also entitled to mine.
That's right, and all you have to do now is redefine where the origin of the word jazz came from, and
uh-oh,
that will stop them in their tracks. George, I really appreciate it. And let us tell folks again that you're going to be at Catalina's Bar and Grill on your birthday, Thursday,
yep,
through Saturday.
Yep, it's going to be a birthday bash.
Man, and look at all the presents you're going to get.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. I don't need any presents. All I need is just some people in there having a good time.
That's right. Well, I don't think there's any chance of that not happening. It's going to be packed to the gills. And I really do appreciate the time that you took with us, honest to gosh.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, George. God bless you. Happy birthday.
You too. All right. Thanks.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, mercy, mercy, mercy. Oh, it was just so nice. That was just perfect. A little bit more time than I expected. He is full boogity rehearsing and then, of course, producing with some other folks and a couple of surprises he told me about I didn't know. So apparently this was some real limited time that he had. And by golly, we're just going to make sure that we trail out this hour with important pieces. We were talking to you about Someday from I Love the Blues. She Heard My Cry, and we're going to get to it right now. This is from 1974, 1975, George Duke, Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Check this out. Yeah.
Just
Hyper Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Got nothing but love for you, George Duke. Thanks so much for dropping by and hanging out and spending over 35 minutes with us. Woo, a lot more than I expected. God bless him. That is from Reach For It, 1977. Thought we'd end with that. Yeah, so nice. So, so nice. All about home. Bring it on home. And before that, Deja Vu. We had a little of both. when we were talking to George, and just to tell you about those times in the mid-70s, those were the times of Stanley Clarke and Mike Cimbello and Ndugu and Byron Miller, and man, that was some of the biggest selling stuff that George had done. Reach For It, matter of fact, broke out in D.C. and Detroit, the title track there. And the whole reason for the project is because there was something going on at the Cellar Door, which was a big club in D.C., and the idea just sprung from there. Just having, listen, you don't know how much of a tie George Duke has to Baltimore, D.C., and Philly. He might have been born and raised in California and might be living there now, but man, he's got some good memories coming to the East and the Mid-Atlantic. Yes. We heard Deja Vu, title track from the most recent CD, actually 2010, and Sarah Thornhill doing an amazing job on the violin, the Eclipse Quartet of violinist Sarah Thornhill, and George working that Yamaha Motif ES-8, Larry Kimple on bass there. Just that whole vibe of the Mahavishnu Orchestra from back in that day. And, man, you want a little something for everybody, you pick up Deja Vu, because we also heard You Bring Me Joy, which has that strong, strong R&B flavor to it. And then there's certainly a nod or two to Frank Zappa on there. We got some funk, we got some fried, we got some fine, all of that on Deja Vu. And if you go to georgeduke.com, you will find a plethora of information. And actually, I think that George and his wife might decide to update the website. I didn't know, and I didn't know that I was going to be part and parcel of him going, oh, we've got to change some stuff on the website. But whatever it takes, he's going to be a busy guy in 2012. I don't think that that's going to be any strange news to you. Amazing stuff. Catalina Bar and Grill this Thursday, George Duke's birthday. He's going to be there Friday as well, and he's going to be there on Saturday. Go to georgeduke.com and find out all the particulars. Of course, there's going to be some dates with some folks that he told you about, and that's how you keep apprised. I will make sure I do that on Facebook. Thank you to Griselda for being there. Thank you to Rick for being there. Thank you to Mike for being there, all our other guests. I will tell you this. Sasha Vasandani joins me on Thursday. I'm very excited. He's going to be part of an Indian music series that's coming to Blues Alley in Washington, D.C. And upcoming, this is the first I've spoken of this, coming up this month will be amazing artists. Lori Williams doing a birthday gig at Blues Alley. And Lori just did some work with George Duke not that long ago. Also coming up a little later this month, Larry Carlton. That is correct, Larry Carlton. God has been good to me, and I pray that he is continuing to be good to you in this beautiful year of 2012. God bless you. We'll see you Thursday. Thank you for all your support, and thanks for being there.